There have been two mass shootings in recent weeks, one at a Planned Parenthood in Colorado and the other at a social services facility in San Bernardino, California.
Mike Wagner is with us to talk about how the media has been covering these recent shootings. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back. Always good to talk to you.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Before we get into some of the how they cover it and maybe the slant in the coverage, I want to talk about the amount of coverage. We've got these breaking news stories. Almost round-the-clock coverage on the cable. It's all over the internet, and it's often two facts repeated again and again in speculation. What do you make of what you've seen in these last couple incidents?
Well, journalists are sure getting a lot of practice at covering these things. They're happening so often, it seems, lately. And when these events break, very little is known. And this, as you say, the same facts are kind of repeated over and over, or the same what they think to be are the facts are repeated over and over. We saw in the San Bernardino situation at first, there were reports of three shooters, all men. Of course, that turned out not to be true. And at the same time, you have some reporters who are sort of veterans of this kind of coverage saying, usually the early reports are erroneous, so we're not going to go with too much about what we're hearing or seeing on Twitter. We'll say that oftentimes these end up being a lone shooter, and then there began to be speculation that the shooter in San Bernardino was a lone gunman and that this was a workplace violence situation. But of course, we then found out that in fact, that it seems the FBI believes that the shooter and his wife were, or both shooters, were radicalized for quite some time and behaved very differently than the initial reporting seemed. And so usually what we know at first is something terrible is happening. We're not sure when it's going to stop, and we're not quite sure how many people have died or are injured or who exactly did this, and we certainly usually don't know why in the early going.
There's a lot of conflicting motives in the reporting,
right.
I think. One, obviously, I think most, hopefully all journalists want to get things right, but there's also, you want to get things first.
Yes.
And also you want to, the public in these cases is watching. They want to hear stuff, so you want to give them stuff to hear. How do they perform that balancing act?
Well, they can almost feel the audience at home knowing that in a live situation, they're armed with their second screen. They can watch on their phone or their iPad or device. They can click to see what all the different channels are doing. They can surf the radio to see who has what, when, what's the latest information. This channel says two shooters. This channel says three. And so reporters are really stuck, and also they're stuck because a lot of the information they're getting from sources that they trust in a police department or from the FBI or from a local community's, kind of city governance structure are telling journalists what they know, but what they think they know. But in fact, it may just be that it's really early and that one eyewitness and another eyewitness's testimony, you guessed it, disagree with each other, and it's hard to know where the information streams are coming from, and that makes it really hard to tell the truth in these breaking situations. And so journalists would do a better job to say we don't know much. It sure looks like something awful is happening, but we don't know more than what we can officially confirm, or that official sources, usually law enforcement, want us to tell you in this situation. Everything else is usually speculation and often ends up being wrong.
One argument I've seen play out since these shootings, and in shootings in the past, I should say, is that the media treats the shooters differently based on their race and faith background. The argument's made that when there's a white shooter in the Charleston case, in the Colorado Planned Parenthood, the claim has been that there's more attention to, this is a troubled person, misfit, never fit in, less attention to the background maybe, or less, a different tone if there's an African-American shooter, and it's still another one if it's, in the San Bernardino case, Muslims. So, huge issue. What do you make of what you've seen lately?
There is some evidence that criticism stands on firm ground. There's evidence that when a shooter is African-American, often words like angry appear in stories about them and are way more likely to appear. When the shooter is white, rarely is their religious faith mentioned as compared to when a shooter is Muslim. And so if a shooter is Muslim, their religion is mentioned in almost every story that references them. And so it's very complicated to think about how these stories are covered, but the way that these stories are framed certainly affect how people interpret the danger to themselves, how they interpret what's happened in the community where it's happened, and also affects how people out on in the political world make comments, as we've seen this week with Donald Trump and others.
Here's a clip from The Daily Show mocking MSNBC's coverage of the San Bernardino shooters. The clip starts with MSNBC's coverage.
Unfortunately, there appears to be a little bit of a pushing and shoving, which I'm not sure we need to do. But as we step inside, we'll take a look and see what we have.
Oh, really? The pushing and shoving is what you're not sure you need to do? Really? You know, I know I'm still learning the news networks here, but is it supposed to be like the movie Nightcrawler? Is that what's happening? You know that movie where Jake Gyllenhaal runs into crime scenes with a camera to get pictures of dead bodies? Because I think MSNBC took that movie as an instructional video.
So this is when they were in the shooter's apartment looking around, and there was a lot of controversy about this.
Right. NBC and MSNBC's Kerry Sanders on live television started rummaging through their stuff. Law enforcement had said, we're done with this area now, and had taken everything that they felt was of interest to them. But there was showing of people's photographs, social security cards, like calendars in the home, but especially photographs of children, and not their children, but just people now being linked to this situation on live television with no vetting of the information. It was kind of this very peculiar and uncomfortable search through a home on live television, and they, I think, quite rightly received quite a lot of criticism for doing that.
What's at stake, briefly, Mike, as we wrap up this issue, when the media gets it wrong early?
The first things that people hear shape our interpretation of what happened, and if what we learned was wrong, it affects how we think about the whole situation even after we learn the facts.
We're picking up our discussion now with Mike Wagner of UW-Madison about how the media is covering Donald Trump and his presidential campaign since he made these comments on Monday.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Mike, a lot of observers seeing a change in how the media talks about Donald Trump, especially since those remarks on Monday. What do you make of that?
Well, I think some of that was led in part by the mainstream media on television, especially NBC ran a long opinion piece from Tom Brokaw, the former anchor of the NBC Nightly News, where he ran a story calling Trump's ideas dangerous and un-American, and ran a whole and featured Joe McCarthy and other kinds of demagogues in the history of the story, and then also featured a Muslim American soldier who joined after 9/11 and was killed in Iraq to push back against the Trump claim. And since then, especially, lots of media have been pushing back hard against Trump's ideas about what you heard in the clip.
I've been reading some media analysis today before the show, and some people are kind of pointing toward three stages of Trump coverage. One, haha, Donald Trump.
Right.
Two, we're getting really good ratings from talking about Donald Trump. Let's keep doing it. And now, and this is this week in particular, we're not sure we should be covering Donald Trump so much. Some people saying we should ignore Donald Trump's. Others saying, BuzzFeed, I think, saying we can call Trump in our coverage a mendacious racist, I think was the phrase they used. So what do you make of the three stages of Trump coverage?
Well, it's a lot like stages of other kinds of scandals and other things that are usually kind of infotainment kinds of things. And you could think about coverage of different scandals in the media. You know, years ago when a congressman's intern, Chandra Levy, went missing and was found dead, that was, you know, 24/7 on the cable news. And then it was, wow, we're getting great ratings. And then it was, should we really be doing this? And it's the same kind of thing we're hearing from the news media about Trump. The Huffington Post first put him on the entertainment page. They just recently took him off and said, no, this is serious enough to cover in politics. But now people are starting to wonder, gee, the correlation between our attention in the news media and Trump's ratings in the polls is really high. We're not paying as much attention to the other candidates. Is that fair? What's Trump doing with this attention? Those questions are now starting to get asked by news providers.
Let's give a listen to Donald Trump on Morning Joe Tuesday when he kept talking and talking, even as the hosts were trying to ask questions.
Donald, you got to let us ask questions. Good. You can't just talk. No, you got to let us actually ask questions. You're just talking.
Donald, you're not going to keep talking.
We will go to break if you keep talking. We're going to ask you questions.
Go to break, everybody.
Right now. We'll be right back with more Morning Joe.
Talk that there's more pushback from people while they're interviewing Donald Trump. Vivid example there.
Yeah, and what's remarkable is that when they came back from break, Trump stayed on the phone, and they actually did do a little bit of a Q&A for a few minutes after that. But it is the case where the news media are starting to push back on Trump. They're doing so on social media. They're doing so when they're able to interview him. But Trump is very adept at dealing with the news media. And even in that case, on Morning Joe, he's doing it on the phone. He has a little bit more control there. He can just hang up. He has a little more control over the situation than he would if he was in their studio having to face them in the same kind of way to face those questions. And so until the news media push back a little harder and treat Trump the same way they treat everybody else, you don't see Jeb Bush calling into these shows in the way that you get, see Trump allowed to, things are probably going to continue to be covered in Trump's favor.
I've read some analysis suggesting early on the political reporters thought, oh, Donald Trump, he doesn't get politics. He's not going to know how to do this stuff. People are starting to say Donald Trump understands TV better than any of these candidates out there. He knows how to say things to get TV coverage, and he understands that. For him, anyway, there's no such thing as bad publicity, it seems like.
He wrote about it in The Art of the Deal. He said, basically, you need to tell, you know, small hyperbolic lies to the news media to get lots of attention. And if you do, you'll get lots of attention. And that's okay, in his view. And that's the kind of thing he's been doing on the campaign trail. He hasn't been doing things other candidates for office do, like setting up lots of field offices for get-out-the-vote operations and cultivating relationships with elected officials in states. He's not doing those things. He's certainly not doing the things that politicians who win presidential nominations do, but he's a master right now at affecting television news coverage of his candidacy.
If you were consulted by a cable network, say, or a major daily newspaper, what advice would you give them on how to handle this? What he says is relevant. He's a front runner in polls. He's a major candidate at this point anyway.
Absolutely.
But how much is too much?
I would say we will establish a set of ground rules with Mr. Trump and all of the candidates we interview, and the rules are these. We're going to ask you a question about policy. If you don't answer it, we'll interrupt you and ask it again. If you don't answer it, that's all of the interview, and we're not going to talk to you anymore. This is our air. This is our channel. If you don't want to answer the questions, you don't have to be here.
If Trump supporters see that, do they care? Are they,
no,
or will they
really
just see this as, oh, see, the mainstream media, the mainstream politicians ganging up on the guy who's talking our language?
Yeah. Dave Weigel, a reporter, I believe, for the Washington Post, sat in on a focus group of Trump supporters and came away with the conclusion that when the mainstream media attack, it reinforces support that many people who like Donald Trump have for Donald Trump. And that's consistent with what political scientists and psychologists know about how people react when they're given information that they don't want to believe about things that they like. And in this case, if you like Donald Trump and you hear things that he said about women or Mexicans or Muslims or Rosie O'Donnell, and you decide, yes, I don't like those things, or I don't like those groups either, and I'm more and more for Trump as he gets criticized for talking about those things.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Mike, I can't think of any examples like this in my lifetime.
Yeah, this is new, I think. You know, he has no political experience. His business experience, he inherited his wealth and has performed worse than just having invested it in mutual funds would have done. And yet he's incredibly well-known and fairly popular amongst a sizable segment of people who are relevant to who gets nominated for president. It's a very peculiar thing we're seeing.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about media coverage of mass shooters, first of all, and then Donald Trump's recent comments and his presidential campaign.
Last night, hundreds of retired Teamsters, former truck drivers, dock workers, and others provided feedback on a rescue plan their pension fund is considering to save it from going broke. Labor expert Frank Emsbach joins us now to talk about how this happened and what retirees could be facing. Frank is the executive producer of Workers Independent News. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well, first off, what is Central States Pension Fund proposing here?
Well, first of all, the question is, what are they? They are a multi-employer pension plan. And a multi-employer pension plan is a plan negotiated between many employers and the union. In this case, there's about 1,500 employers that were in the Central States plan, and they cover about 402,000 people. So it's a significant pension plan. What's being proposed is, or what the trustees of the plan have proposed, is that in order to save the plan, they have to reduce benefits of the people who are already retired.
By how much?
Well, it depends. If you're over 80, not at all. If you're a widow over 75, a little bit or not at all. But if you're in your late 60s and you've worked, say, for 30 years, and the company you worked for went bankrupt, which is one of the problems here, considerably amount, maybe 30%, 40%, a huge amount, actually, because the people are affected differently. So I think that first we need to understand what the plan is, and then second, how can you take away somebody's pension after they've earned it? And that gets us into changes in federal law that were made last year in December.
Right. Well, let's talk about that change in law. You're right. December of 2014, a law passed that allowed plans like this to cut benefits. So tell us a little bit about the backstory for how that law got passed.
Well, of course, I don't know how it got passed. A lot of laws get passed, though, and nobody has a clue as to what's going on. In this case, the law was passed in order from the point of view of the people who supported it to save pension plans. Up until then, under the original laws called ERISA, you couldn't change or reduce a pension that somebody was already taking. You couldn't do that. The plan couldn't just say, "Well, we're cutting it." If a plan went bankrupt, there is an organization called the Pension Guarantee Corporation, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, that's supposed to pay the minimum that plan that would go bankrupt would pay. But anyway, December 2014 rolls around, and a number of plans, multi-employer plans, particularly in construction and in trucking, were faced with major, major problems. Either they went bankrupt or they would have to reduce their payments. Under the law at the time, they could not reduce their payments. So it was sort of one way or the other. And so not all organizations, for sure, but some agreed that they would support something called the Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act of 2014. And what that did is it allowed distressed funds to cut promised benefits. And I was in Washington, actually, when that was passed and talking to people on both sides. And people who supported it said, look, if we don't do this, the entire plan's going to go and nobody will get anything. And so some people in Congress were, moved by that. What seemed to be absent from the discussion, at least I didn't hear it, was that everything was treated as a zero-sum game and that nothing could be done. And so I think that we as a society have a real challenge here. We can get on to what that is in a minute. But this plan is huge, and approximately 200,000 people out of the 400,000 will have some negative effect if the plan administrators are allowed by Judge Feinberg, who's now put in charge of this, to cut the plan. So I think this gets very complicated. You know, you have now a federal administrator, Feinberg, who's been sent in to hear what people have to say, and then he can decide a number of different things. He could decide it has to stay the same. Good luck. He can decide that the plan is insolvent, but I don't think it's quite insolvent according to everything in the paper. Or he can say, look, I'll give you permission to make certain benefit cuts. So he is doing these listening sessions. This is the second one. I think there's a third one. There was one in Ohio. I believe it was Tuesday.
Now, you're mentioning these listening sessions, and some of the affected retirees last night said they hadn't been given a chance to comment when the initial law passed in 2014. Why wasn't there public comment?
Well, as far as I can tell, there were no public hearings at all, or if they were, they were pretty quiet. And I think the law was sort of rushed through at the end, just like this week. You know, there's this huge trillion-dollar spending bill with all kinds of riders and hundreds of pages, and it's going to be voted on Sunday. Well, last year was the same story. We have to vote on it, keep the government open, you know, and it's midnight, and all of a sudden, you know, there are lots and lots of pieces of legislation that get passed in this last week of the session, basically, and same thing happened in 2014, although then you had a number of people who were very interested in the bill lobbying for its passage, but there wasn't a big public discussion about the implications of the bill.
So looking at Central States Pension Fund, again, a multi-employer plan, seems to be the problem underpinning this is that it's underfunded. So how did that happen?
Well, underfunding pension plans is people write books about it, and we have, you know, like 30 seconds, I suspect. But here's what happened with this plan. You had approximately 1,500 employers. That's a huge number of employers. And in the trucking industry, well, in 1980, the trucking industry is deregulated. Anybody can do anything, basically, at that point. It had been what we sort of a regulated monopoly, more or less, where rates were set. Well, what happened as a result of deregulation is that a large number of trucking companies went bankrupt, so they could no longer pay into the fund. They weren't there, even though their ex-employees were going to benefit from it, you know, 20 years later, like now, like 2015, so 25 years later, 35 years later. So the incoming money went down. So that's bad enough, okay? Then you have, in 2008, you know, a financial crisis in this country. The fund had an awful lot of money tied up in real estate. There's criticisms about their management and so on and so forth. But, you know, they, like everybody else, took a real bath. And so the value of their investments dropped, even though, as 2008, 2009, the number of people retiring increases because people are getting older. So you have both a cut in income and an increase in expenses, and no way to really make it up. Because the employers that were paying into the fund were saying, wait a minute, there's a limit here. I can't, you know, be responsible for everybody. And so one of the problems with an employee fund or a challenge is that the ones that are left have to pay everything, so including for the people that have left or had gone bankrupt. So there's an inherent tension here, and all of this has to do with the fact that our pension system in general is underfunded and doesn't really work very well when you have consolidations and continuing reductions in employment and stagnation, as we've had now for 30 years, in wages.
And looking at where we are right now, what would the alternative be to cuts like these?
Well, there could be no cuts, and I suppose the plan could become insolvent, and then the pension guarantee company could take it over. That's a government agency, basically. But the problem is that the size of this fund is such that it would bankrupt that government agency. Another thing to do would be to really reform and take a look at our system here and make a commitment that you'll put enough money into the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation to pay this fund and everybody else's that need it, because it's an obligation that the generations have. And so that if there's a problem, the basic benefits of this fund get paid. So it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. This is a wealthy country. Overall, I think that particularly in a state like this where we have an older population, we need to think about the basis of our retirement system. For those of you who no doubt remember, right, when 1933 rolled around, right? I don't think we have too many people in the audience who were there then. But the idea was old age and survivor's benefits. That's because we had this huge problem in this country of millions of older people starving, you know, being destitute because there was no income when they retired. So we got what is now Social Security. The theory was one-third of your income would come from Social Security, one-third from savings, and one-third from a pension. Well, as it turns out, in 2015 now, most people don't have savings of any amount that could help them out. The top 1% do, or the top 5%, but almost nobody else does. And when we get to the pension end, many, many pensions were transformed into 401ks or IRAs. People thought, oh, great, stock market's going up, great idea. Well, stock market didn't go up forever. And so most people, more than half, do not have enough money in that IRA to survive after retirement.
And Frank, just in our last minute here, how important is this? What's riding on this decision, and is it going to be a bellwether for workers and other industries and other pension plans?
Well, there are many, many underfunded and improperly funded multi-employer plans. And so people are looking at this to say, what's going to happen if this one is allowed to make these huge changes? What's going to happen to the other ones? There's about 1.5 million people, 2 million people, who are in pension plans, at least according to the various CNN and whatnot, that are in trouble. And so this could be an example of what could happen. This is the first major plan that's going to be dealt with under this new law where benefits can be reduced. So people will be looking at what the administrator does, and then if he gives the plan permission to reduce benefits, what they're going to do.
Frank, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Frank Emsbach, executive producer of Workers Independent News. He joined us to talk about possible cuts to the pensions of many retired Teamsters.